This is the Muscles and Management Podcast, where we build your body and your business. Talking all things training, sports performance, and business for athletes and aspiring coaches to enhance your training and better your career. Muscles and Management is brought to you by Challenger Strength with your host, Jerry DiFilippo.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 66 of the Muscles and Management Podcast. As always, please rate, review, and subscribe. If you guys can help me out with those, that would be great. I just want to take a second to kind of say this to everybody. And I'm going to try to practice what I preach because it's been a stressful time for me as well. There's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of things, scary things going on with the, coronavirus outbreak. And I am remaining positive, considering the fact that, things are very much so portrayed to be in such a dire situation on, the news or the media or whatever you're looking at. I will say that I think we are doing the right thing with our country and, the steps we're taking. I do think that, there needs to be people that are sympathetic. There's a lot of people that I know, and I'm sure I have a lot of listeners who have, private businesses that are very worried right now. I don't see them keeping businesses closed for longer than a few weeks as they will understand the ramifications of that. But I also think that they're doing this, to get out in front of this thing and to try to, make it as, lethal as possible and make it as, have as little of an impact on our healthcare system as possible, with understanding that, while we're going to have to make adjustments, they cannot be this extreme for the long haul. It'll just have too many negative implications. But with all that said, if you're going through a situation right now where you don't know where money's going to come from, you're worried, I'm not even going to try to say things to make you feel better because there's nothing I can do. And I apologize that you have to go through that. I'm sorry. That I can only imagine how tough that is. If you're somebody that's kind of just in limbo right now, who's just, upset and wants to get back to work or wants us all to end, be patient, stick it out, try to be positive. And just know that there's a lot of variables going around and a lot of things happening. And, don't take any good news to be too good or any bad news to be too bad, because we don't know the, full context of everything and, when this officially will kind of be at the wayside. So just try to stay strong. And I hope something having these episodes is kind of keeping people sane and, keeping them able to learn through this whole thing. So I just wanted to say that. So stay strong, everybody. And to anybody that's had a family member affected by this, my thoughts are with you. Or anybody that has anyone that is sick, my thoughts are with you as well. Basically, thoughts are with anybody who's sick, anybody who's, having financial issues, whatever it is. I'm sorry. And I wish there was something I could do, but my thoughts are with you in this time. With that said, on to some positive stuff. If you haven't, check out Monday's first inaugural episode of the Meathead Monday series. Really satisfied with how that went. And I think you guys are going to like these going forward. They're going to be chock full of information and, less away from the interview side of things as the usual Wednesday episodes will be. So check that out if you haven't yet. I did a great talk on, using the basically strong enough and that whole topic and, why black and white isn't the way to go and how we need to learn testing processes to see, when strength may have diminishing returns on performance. How do we know that? Why you can like speed training and also like strength training, how they can mesh together, all that good stuff. Previous episodes, episode 64, Ken Clark, speaking of speed, just a great overall episode on acceleration, all the mechanics, the implications of the mechanics, resisted sprinting, you name it, it's in there. Check that out. He was great. Episode 63, we had the Q&A that I did with Mike as the moderator. That was great. Check that out. And then episode 62, Driveline's Anthony Brady. Just a fantastic listen if you're interested in rotational athletes, pitchers, throwers, and all the stuff that goes into that and the biomechanical analysis of that. Coming soon, we have obviously, as the announcement that I've been making, a Meathead Monday coming every Monday of the week. In terms of our Wednesday episode with guests, we have Ben Brewster coming on. That will be episode 68 next Wednesday. Billy Anderson coming on the week after that. That will be episode 70. Remember what I said, the Meathead Monday is counting as episodes. So, episode 70 the week after that with Billy Anderson. And then I also have episode 72, or from, might be missing out my numbers here. And this is why I have an Excel sheet so I can check. But I'll have an episode with basically a reverse interview I did where I talk about and give explanations behind individualization of programming, strategies I use to do that, and things like that. It was an impromptu phone call that turned into an hour plus of me answering questions on all things about programming and individualization and strategies that I use. So that's going to be the week after the Billy Anderson episode. Billy Anderson, by the way, the head of sports performance for University of South Carolina, and or director of sports performance, excuse me. And then the week after that, the interview I did, the reverse interview I did, I have Bill Hazell from Driveline and also now a consultant with the Phillies for pitching. He was great. I just actually did that interview today, and you're going to love that one. So a lot of cool stuff coming up. And like I said, give me feedback on the Meathead Mondays. Let me know what you guys think. In the meantime, enjoy this conversation with Brandon Howard. He was fantastic. Just a guy that works with a lot of high-level athletes at Texas Tech and has a lot of interesting things to say and a lot of good insight on a lot of common topics. So enjoy this, guys. I know you guys are going to love this one. Until next time, peace. All right, everyone. Excited to welcome on Brandon Howard. Brandon, thanks so much for your time. I'm thrilled to have you.
Appreciate it. Glad to be on.
For sure. So sometimes one of the things I like to do when I have a coaching guest, especially in strength training, is to kind of get a little insight, you know, on their background, you know, with athletics personally, coaching philosophy, things like that. And something that generally interests me is like what their training consisted of as an athlete, you know, as I find that's like a big thing that kind of inspires us as coaches is like our first experiences in our own training. You know, what did that consist of for you?
Well, yeah, it kind of goes back all the way to my high school days. You know, I'm originally from Jacksonville, Florida. Went to the Bowl School, which is a private school in Jacksonville, and I was really exposed to my first strength coach, a guy by the name of Mike Barrett. Coach Barrett was the first guy that kind of I was able to learn how to train and work out as an eighth grader as I was going into high school. So that was really my first exposure to weight training and just athletic preparation in general. So he was a big influence on, you know, my initial love for the weight room. So as a high school athlete, I played football, threw the shot, discus, and track, and then also did high school weightlifting. So I was exposed to Olympic lifting pretty early on. You know, in the state of Florida, it's a little bit different. It's clean and jerk and bench press, which the two kind of don't really go together. But that was kind of, you know, what we did. And that was my first exposure to Olympic lifts. You know, as I got into college, I signed a football scholarship to East Carolina University, played there for 4 years. And that was really where I kind of fell in love with the weight room even more, but knew kind of initially on and off that I wanted to become, you know, a college strength coach. And so I had some really great strength coaches, Jim Witten, who was there for 2 years of my time. And then John Grieco, after that, were my two strength coaches at East Carolina at the time. And both of those guys really kind of got me into it and said, you know, this would be something you'd be really good at. So in terms of and the way that we trained then, you know, it was, you know, very, very similar to what a lot of guys are still doing, right? We did cleans, we did jerks, we did snatches, we did, you know, we push, we pull, we hinge. You know, we did, you know, those basic strength movements. Now, this was in the early 2000s. So in terms of the way that we trained, it still has a lot of influence on what I do. I think more what's maybe changed over the years and as I've continued to learn and progress is kind of how I do it. And, you know, learning from different people and different mentors and friends that I've had in the profession. You know, after I got done with college, you know, I became a graduate assistant, and that's where I was really introduced to really the intricacies of competitive Olympic lifting. A really great mentor and friend of mine, Richard Borden. Richard is one who got me into competitive Olympic lifting. And so now I'm still a competitive Olympic lifter. And that's kind of in terms of sports and how I got into it. That's kind of where my background kind of comes from.
For sure. So it's definitely pretty cool. Like I personally speaking, I didn't really lift heavy. Like I was a baseball player and I was just kind of my experiences with lifting kind of came from my dad who was like into the, you know, bodybuilding type of stuff. So I always find it interesting to ask that question because obviously like what I was doing as an athlete, it was so different up until about college was so different than what I would, you know, do with an athlete now or what I would do as a strength coach. So pretty cool to see, you know, to hear that you really established that base early on, like even with some of the strength coaches you were lucky to have and, you know, up until college and all that kind of stuff. It's pretty cool to see that it transferred over to your philosophy as a coach for what you did as an athlete.
Absolutely. And I've been lucky, you know, I've been exposed to a lot of great coaches in my career. You know, I said, when I finished at East Carolina, I became a graduate assistant at Utah State. And at the time, I met Mark Liama, Mark, who is currently the head strength coach for the Minnesota Vikings. Mark was the first guy that got me into it. And I learned a lot. I worked for him for a year before he left and went into the NFL with the San Francisco 49ers. I learned a great deal from Mark about just what it was like to be in a college weight room, how to understand and kind of see things before they happen, you know. And then my initial intros into how to program, truly program for athletes, came from him and his influences from Joe Ken and the tier system. That was kind of where I initially started in terms of my growth as a strength coach, and just learning how to really run a program and how to train my athletes and how to kind of progress things, you know, through, you know, the principles of progressive overload and periodization models, whether it be linear undulating, those things. Those are really where I was got my intros with him. Then I went on to work at Georgia Southern University under Tom Milton. Tom is a disciple of Joey Batson. Obviously, we know the great things he's done at Clemson University. So I was introduced to some of the West Side methodology that they use, you know, some of the dynamic effort, max effort type days that we did there. So I was introduced to some of the accommodating resistance type stuff. So there was, you know, I was lucky to be able to get some different varieties of training and some different types of people. You know, I was lucky to work for Tom for 4 years, and, you know, we did some great things at Georgia Southern, which, like I said, that place is a special place to me. I took my first head strength and conditioning job at Southeastern Louisiana University. So that was a huge learning curve for me at the time, to get to run an entire program, run an FCS program, football, baseball, men's basketball, you name it, we did it, you know. So, and in terms of that, I was able to really learn about not necessarily time management, but how to deal with every sport, every coach, all the administration, all those things. And I think, you know, some of it I had to learn on the fly. And I think that was an awesome opportunity for me to kind of progress and learn, and then be able to kind of start reaching out and putting my own tweaks and fine tuning things on the way that I really see a program going, you know. And I was spent four great years there. We did a lot of great things, and went to Utah State again, back out to where I'd done graduate school, and worked with a really close friend and mentor, David Scholes. Coach Scholes is who I currently work for here at Texas Tech. And what Coach Scholes had really opened my eyes up to was the nutritional aspect. One of the smartest guys I've ever met in terms of athletic performance and nutrition. He exposed me to a lot of the teachings of Charles Poliquin. So I've really been able to learn some of the things that Charles taught, you know. So I'm able to take some of the things that Coach Scholes taught me from his time dealing with Charles, all the different mentors that he's had, from the nutrition aspect, and has really opened my eyes and really changed the way that I kind of see things, and the way that I organize my training, the way I look at training from a time under tension standpoint. You know, we do a lot of different training in terms of how we bend, how we move, how we progress and teach our athletes. You know, Dave, like I said, I've known Dave, and I were GAs at Utah State at one point. And like I said, he's a really great friend and a really good mentor, and a guy that I've learned quite a great deal from in the last 4 or 5 years. Before I came out here to Texas Tech, I spent the last year at Ole Miss with Paul Jackson, who's currently at the University of South Carolina. Paul is one of the best that I've seen in terms of managing a room, taking control of a room, but he's really, really an amazing, amazing coach when it comes to linear speed, change of direction, plyometrics. Mm-hmm. You know, being able to be around him and learn from him was unbelievable. You know, so I've been extremely lucky. I've had some great friends and great mentors and great people to learn from. And a lot of the things that I've been able to pick up over my time is really kind of gone into the way that I'm going to program and continue to program and train my athletes in the future.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think being a strength coach and having, you know, strong and consistent influences, whether, you know, working for somebody, you know, even in today's day and age with social media and the internet, I always tell people, like, you know, you can have a mentor that doesn't know you exist. Like, you can just follow what they do on social media, and people have websites now, and everyone's kind of, I'm doing it on Twitter, and people reach out to me and say, hey, you've had a, you know, big influence on, you know, what I do with coaching, and I've never even met them before. So it's cool that, you know, it's been easier to have that, you know, the fortune of that, as social media has become a thing. The other thing you mentioned that I thought was really key and I wanted to kind of touch on is people sometimes don't understand the implications that, you know, the big team setting can have on what you do as a coach. You know, right. As I always say, like, that perfect program looks great until you get like punched in the mouth when you walk in and there's 20, you know, kids there that are 30 kids maybe needing to train. And it's like, all right, well, like, now I actually have to implement this. Like, what's going to actually be practical to do with this, you know, amount of athletes, and, you know, what isn't going to be, because people really don't understand that sometimes. And you mentioned right at the end there, I believe it was your, at Ole Miss, that, the coach you worked under could really command a room and, you know, be able to get things done with a large amount of group of athletes. Like, in your experience, what is that like? And, you know, try to relate to the listeners, like, how things change when you have to actually implement a program with a large group.
Well, and, you know, a lot of it comes from knowing your kids and knowing your room, right? It's knowing what you have. You know, if I don't have the room or the equipment or the implements that I need, you know, I'm not going to, it's like trying to force a square peg into a round hole. It's just not going to work.
Yeah.
So that comes from it doesn't just come from, hey, I've got to know what this does. It comes from the months, the weeks prior, the planning that you go through. You know, Coach Scholes does a great job with our staff. We meet multiple times. Like I said, we're getting ready, obviously, to transition into summer here, and we're going to start meeting on our summer program here starting next week. So it's more about, you know, really, really planning. And that, some of that actually goes back to Coach Uyama. He's like, you know, it's one of those things where you have to always plan ahead, always understand what can come up. And I think when you understand that, any little thing that may come up during a training session, especially in a large group setting, you're going to kind of already have been prepared for it, you know? So it really comes from preparation. And when you're prepared and you know what's going to go, you know, what's going to happen, and you anticipate things going to happen, you know, like I said, with Coach Jackson, it's one of those things where it allows you to continue to really understand the room and take charge of the room, because you already know what could happen before it ever does.
Yeah.
You know, and then a lot of that, not only that, it comes from the respect factor that he's developed, and not only him, but Coach Scholes, going back to Uwe, Coach Melton, all the mentors that I've had and all the friends that I've had and that I've worked with, it's developing and it's being able to build that confidence from your athletes. And they know when things are getting there and I'm telling you what to do, we're going over the session, whether it be a speed session, conditioning session, whether it be training, they know and they're locked in, and I can command the room with just my voice or just their voice. And that's really what it comes down to. So being prepared, building confidence in your athletes, and building that respect factor over time, I think that all goes into how you really control a room.
Yeah, absolutely. If you notice too, like, I've noticed this for sure, the coaches that have the most control over a large group and a large team, there's not a lot of like yelling that needs to be done from the coach, you know, in terms of like, get here, get there. Like, the guys know the routine, the way things are supposed to be done. And, the coach kind of commands, like you said, that respect, commands, not even in like a, they ask for it when they haven't really, you know, given a reason to get it. They command it because of just what they do day in and day out. And the guys have trust, or the girls have trust in them, and, you know, the results they're able to get, and, you know, how they work the room and all that kind of stuff. It really just kind of all culminates into, you know, that, you know, an ideal environment. And another thing you mentioned too is, you know, trying to fit a round peg in a square hole. It's like, if I have 30 athletes and 3 squat racks and I want to bench press, well, that's going to be kind of tough. I've noticed that, like, there is really something to be said about, and you kind of alluded to this, you know, programming based on, like, you know, if I have one glute ham machine, I'm not going to have, you know, every single athlete just stand in a line and do their glute hams. Like, I'm going to have to figure something out to make it a little more, you know, mainstream, for lack of a better word, for like the large production line type setting, where like, hey, like, I need to get guys in and out of exercises and have multiple guys working at the same time. you know, I might have to give up an exercise that I'm really, really passionate about and I like, and find something else that, you know, fits the need and gets the need done. That's more, you know, practical.
Correct. It's, you know, it's what can you do to maximize the amount of time you have with your kids and maximize the training session? You know, it doesn't do them any good if you're, like you said, you're trying to find, well, I love glued hams. I have to get them done. Well, I have one glued ham developer. I'm not really going to be able to do that. So what can I, as a coach, what variation can I do to get the same result that I can do inside a group setting or inside this training session? You know, I think that's just knowing, like I said, it goes back to knowing what you have and being able to write a program based on that, as opposed to, you know, just writing this cookie cutter program because somebody else did it. You know, it's using your common sense. It's using your coach's eye and your intuition to be able to develop the proper program for your athlete.
Yeah, absolutely. Very well said. And, two things I kind of wanted to touch on, and this is like kind of I apologize for the double question, but you mentioned, and I really want to get to it because Paulo Quinn's had a big influence on my style of programming. You mentioned Paulo Quinn and tempo. What did you learn from, you know, reading his materials and what he did, and how do you implement it? And I guess the second part of the question would be, you know, how much would you say has changed from like the first program you ever wrote and up until now, and like what you're doing now?
Well, you know, to digress a little bit, in terms of the type of program that I was writing in 2007 or 2008, you know, when I really had that first opportunity to now, I mean, it's night and day. But that, like I said, and I allude back to this, but I've had great mentors and friends and people that I've been able to reach out to over the years that have helped kind of shape my thought process, you know. So, like I said, with our program now, it's been Coach Scholl's program here at Texas Tech with our football team, you know, being around him and being able to see some of the different ways that he's learned from Charles and the way that some of the different things that he's been able to implement has rubbed off on me, and the way that I've, you know, when I have the opportunity to program for our guys or have my input, I understand what we're trying to do, you know. And then when you're really talking about tempo, you know, in terms of tempo, you know, we look at tempo as another training variable that you can manipulate, right? So you can manipulate volume, you can manipulate intensity, and you can manipulate time under attention to elicit a similar response, you know. And something that I learned from Coach Scholl's and from my time that I've been exposed and met with Charles personally and then reading, you know, what we see is longer time under attention is going to elicit more of a hormone response, you know, that you're looking to elicit in your athletes. So we're looking to increase the amount of growth hormone that's produced, the amount of testosterone that's produced, especially in our guys. And what we found is in some of the longer time under tension deals, so some of the longer eccentrics and longer isometrics, that we've been able to do with our kids has really allowed us to increase muscle mass and drive up those hormones so we can allow those kids to grow and gain muscle mass and size, change body composition. I think that's, you know, what I've been able to learn from him over the years is kind of been that. And it's also right. It's one of those things where you use it at different times of the year, right? We're not going to do, you know, slow eccentrics and isometrics in season, right? It's going to elicit too much soreness. You know, that's not what we're going to do in season, but it's something that we will use throughout different portions of our off season.
Yep.
And our transitional periods. You know, we like to use isometrics, you know, why we're overcoming inertia in football. So why not get our offensive and defensive linemen to get comfortable in the bottom of a squat?
Yeah.
Okay. Or
absolutely.
Same thing on the eccentric or the bottom portion of a press.
It also teaches
whether it be an
a
overhead
lot.
Press or an incline press.
It teaches a lot to the athlete about control and actually like feeling tension on the movement. Like, I'm sure you've seen it as much as I have. Like I work with college, you know, level guys, but I also work with some younger athletes, and I've seen, you know, times where you can really tell, like, they're not keen on the idea of moving things slowly and, you know, loading tension for long periods of time. Like, they don't get it yet. And, you know, using tempos can really be a good way to give them that feel and, you know, make sure that they're doing that. Do you have any things that you do that, you know, can help when, you know, maybe a new athlete like isn't really that attentive enough to the tempo they're supposed to be putting into a movement, other than just saying, hey, like three, 2, 1 on the way down? Like, are there ways that you would ensure they're getting the effect you're looking for?
Correct. So, you know, because I do a lot of the programming for our newcomer guys. So anybody that's new to our program, that's part of one of my duties as an associate strength coach, is I write the newcomer program, you know, obviously, and it goes along, it's a way for us to transition our guys into our vet program. But then we will cadence down those guys, and we will cadence down our athletes so they understand what a 3010 tempo is or a 3110 tempo is. We will cadence them 3, 2, 1, hold, up. I mean, we will cadence that. And remember, the biggest thing is when, especially when you're teaching something like that, you want them to understand what it's supposed to feel like, right? Feel the quads on the way up. Feel your hamstrings eccentrically load you and control your body down to the bottom of the squat, you know, or bottom of the press, whatever it might be. So we will cadence that. I mean, we took this program over and we kind of started our entire football program on a pseudo newcomer program. We as coaches were cadencing an entire room. So we had our five coaches. We had one of us who was cadencing when we were teaching our guys how to squat. We were cadencing the entire room. So the whole room was lowering and pausing for the same amount of time. So that goes back to, and you talk about commanding a room. It's one of those things where you're teaching them the expectations of the program and how things are supposed to be done from day one, you know, and that again leads into like what we were speaking about earlier about how to control the room and the respect factor on all those things. So, you know, when we talk about it, it's really one of those things where if it's important to us, we have to make it important to the kids, right? Then they have to understand why we're doing it. So that goes into you as a coach being able to explain all the ins and outs and everything that you're doing and why you're doing it. And I think Coach Scholes and the rest of our staff does a really great job of that, you know, and be able to get these kids to understand the reasoning behind everything we're doing.
Yeah. How much more, I've seen the same thing, how much more likely is an athlete to, like, you know, take the tempo to the extreme that needs to be done in certain circumstances? They understand, like, you know, really easy to relate to athletes to say, like, hey, you're going to do this, it's going to make you jacked. Like, they'll go outside and climb a tree if you tell them it's going to make them, you know, gain muscle mass, right? And if you say to them, like, listen, like, we do this tempo. Like, I've gotten to the point now where, like, when I have big groups come in, like, I'm private sector in a lot of what I do, so it's a little different. But, like, I'll write up on the whiteboard what we have going on today for a certain group. And, you know, I can write, you know, times 12 with, like, a 3 down arrow. And they know that every single rep has a 3-2-1 on the way down. I try to really simplify because we'll screw it up if I don't. But
correct.
You bring up another good point, too, is, like, if you can, like, if I had, you know, 20 baseball players and I wanted them to do YWTs on their stomach in between whatever exercise we were doing, and you just literally make all of them do it at the same time, and you count out the 3-2-1 or the 30 seconds or whatever it is, you know, you can find, you can make sure that guys are doing what they need to be doing and not, you know, skipping through the tempo or whatever, because like you said, it is really important. So I think you brought up a great point of just like, hey, you're going to have someone cadence, like, you know, 6 guys are about to do their squat set, like, they're going to get a coach 5, 4, 3, like, they're counting for them, and it's, you know, keeping everybody in check. And then the athletes almost after a certain amount of time become, you know, accountable, and they can kind of be, you know, assistant coaches for the rest of the team in a sense. I've had that experience at least.
Correct. They'll become self-sufficient. And,
yes.
And that's where we have gotten to an extent with our guys is when we're doing any type of extended isometrics or extended eccentrics, they are counting for one another now.
Yeah.
Same thing. It's a beautiful thing. Counting each other down. They're counting each other down when we're doing some high volume work. So they're holding, they're getting to the point now where they understand how we want it done. Well, when we're doing, we were doing something the other day where there was a last set of 12 and they're counting down 12, 11, 10, 9. They're counting down for their partner. They understand that one, we teach them that some, they count down on those high volume sets because we found that in the long term, it actually makes the guys able to get through it a little bit better than counting up, you know? So that's something that we teach. And it seems very, very minute, right? It's a very small detail, but like I said, Coach Scholes is something that he is very adamant about and that we've kind of told these kids here about. We want you to count down on any type of our high volume sets or any set for that matter. So, you know, those little things that are able to allow you to control the room, but it gives them, you know, a sense of ownership and it gives them a sense of accountability to one another. And, you know, I think that that's a great way to do it. And as you get that culture evolved and it continues to grow and grow and grow, the thing runs itself.
Yeah, it really opens up your ability as a coach to do more for your guys when, like, they have become taught and self-sufficient to do the little things on their own. It really expands your ability to do more for them, really, because you become less of a, you know, cadence guy where you're saying 3-2-1 every time someone squats. And now you can, like, you know, lock in on what they're moving or how they're moving, excuse me, and what they're doing and kind of give them feedback. And it really does expand your ability to coach and be a better strength coach for sure. I've even noticed one of the things that I do effectively sometimes with the guys and it helps them is I will say, hey, you know, here's a 25-pound goblet squat for 12 reps. Make it tough. Like make yourself feel like it's a hypertrophy-based, you know, exercise. And you'll be surprised. Like, it really kind of makes them have to self-organize and determine, like, what they need to do with tempo to actually, like, get an effect out of a light load. So I've done that before, too, and that definitely helps.
Correct. No, that's like I said, anything that you can give them a little bit of ownership on.
Yeah.
I think that not only does it help.
Makes them feel good too.
Them and actually enjoy what they're doing, but the buy-in, it helps the buy-in in the program a lot more. So
for sure.
Yeah. You know, there's anything like that you could do to give them some accountability and some, you know, feel like that they are putting something into the program. I think that's an awesome thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. One kind of last question here, and then I had a whole energy systems things, that, some stuff that I wanted to get into. But if you had to give a tip for any coaches looking to climb an industry, what would they be? Whether it's, you know, someone wanted to be in the private sector with a school maybe instead, or, you know, I guess that was your route. So maybe if you had any tips for that specifically, like, what would you tell a young coach?
Well, what I would tell a young coach is, you know, one, know what you want to do. You know, I think one of the things that you get lost in a little bit is they're like, well, I'm going to try this. And I think you should, but I think at some point you have to know and you have to say, you know, this is the route I'm going to take. And now I'm going to put all my eggs in this basket in terms of I'm going to do everything possible to make this journey happen. So, I mean, if I had to give any information to a young coach, I would say, you know, find a mentor who intrigues you, who you feel is a really smart person, who you feel is somebody that could help you along the way. And by all means, go intern for them for free.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of talk about, oh, well, why should you do this for free? Why should you do that for free? Well, why should these coaches teach you something? You know, why should they just give away all their information? You know,
I've said that and I've gotten yelled at for it before. I'm like, you're going to intern, like, the pay you're getting is the free information that a person is literally just opening up to you. Like, that means more than any $12 or $15 an hour would ever mean to me.
Correct. You know, and that's, I think you find the right mentor, you ask questions, you know, you go and you take time to go learn from as many people as you can. You know, I think the more time you spend on the floor, the better. You know, everybody can, you know, can read, and you can, there's really smart guys out there that are really well read. But I think if you want to be a great coach, you have to get where the bullets are flying, right? You have to get out there and you have to be on the floor in the trenches coaching. Are you going to make mistakes? Yes. Every young coach makes mistakes. Heck, every veteran coach makes mistakes. We all do. Nobody in this thing is perfect, because this field and this job is constantly evolving. But, you know, if I had to give a kid who's maybe asking me, you know, what do I do? Find a mentor, go intern, and get on the floor. All the other stuff can take care of itself. Because, you know, at least for me personally, I found I became a better coach the more I was on the floor. You know, was I a great lifter in college? I was really good in the weight room, all that. But I realized that I didn't really know anything until I got on the other side of the looking glass, as per se, and was able to really how do I look at movement? How do I coach this? How do I work with individual different types of athletes, right? Every athlete's going to respond differently. There's no book that's going to tell you how to coach one kid from another. So I think finding the right people to mentor and intern with, and really just getting on the floor and coaching your butt off. I think that's the biggest information that I can give to any young coach, because if you do those two things well, everything else will kind of roll from there. You know, opportunities will present themselves. You know, if you show this coach or this mentor that you're doing a great job, they're going to be more than willing to stand on the table in an interview process and say, look, I want this guy or this lady. I think that's really what you have to do.
Yeah, I think it's really well said. You mentioned too the getting on the floor experience. Like, one book that you read can multiply in value by 10 if you literally read it and then go spend the next 3 months coaching and like trying to use some of the information that you read. I honestly can say, personally speaking, that I get smarter at a much more rapid rate now that I'm on the floor all day and like don't have as much time as I would, you know, maybe have liked to have had a couple of years ago to read things and do things, et cetera. I feel that, you know, when I had more time to do that, I was learning stuff, but my knowledge has increased, you know, 10, 20 fold since I've been able to actually get on the floor and coach, you know, versus always having my head in a book. So I think it's important to learn stuff and to read and to do things like that. But, you know, that knowledge has compounding interest when you're actually like, you know, seeing how it works and what it does. And, you know, there's only so much information out there in terms of the core philosophies and principles of strength and speed training. The rest of it and getting better at, you know, the intricacies of it and, you know, kind of making it your own. That is like the other 75% of learning, in my opinion. You lay that first 25% down when you first start and you're reading a lot of things when you first get started. The rest of it is just making sure you're keeping up with, like, you know, things that are changing, if things are changing. But, you know, the other component of it is just you're on the floor every day and, you know, you're seeing, you know, how a certain type of, you know, resisted sprint works and the results that it has, a resisted jump or whatever it is. Like, that, in my opinion, is the other 75% of becoming smart and having a lot of knowledge is, you know, application and experience.
Correct. 'Cause you can be the smartest guy in the world and you can spout off anything from anybody's book, whoever it might be. But can you apply it? Can you get it? Can it actually work within the setting that you're looking for, or that the setting that you're in? You know, like, it doesn't do you any good if you're the smartest guy in the room, but you can't relate to your athletes and you can't get your athletes to do what you want. So you have to, you know, Kurt Hester is a friend of mine in the field, and everybody knows Kurt. You know, he wrote his book a little while ago and basically said, you know, the best thing that you can be is a mixture of The Rock and Albert Einstein. I think that was a really, really intuitive metaphor in terms of what you can be as a strength coach, right? You have to have the juice. You have to be smart. You have to have an energy and coach and command, but you have to be smart enough to understand how to implement science and have everything go from a science base and be able to implement it within your program or within that team setting. So, you know, I really think that's what it is. I don't think you can be too far to one side or the other personally.
Yeah, absolutely. There's definitely something to be said about, like, making sure you're not, you know, having your head buried in the sand and doing things that maybe the time has passed them by and it's been found that there are other things that are more effective. But, at the end of the day, you know, just being a bookworm and not ever applying anything isn't the way to go either. So as anything, it's a healthy balance for sure. Right. Speaking of something you would read a lot about, and this is something I actually, when I was putting this outline together last night, I saw a thread, you know, with some high school football coaches basically arguing with some strength coaches about, you know, conditioning in football and, you know, running 400 yard sprints. I didn't even know that was like something people did. And like running, you know, 21 tens and all this other, you know, crazy stuff. And basically, in my opinion, from what I've seen, it's the energy systems are one of the most bastardized areas of sports performance. And one of the big arguments that I see made sometimes when people kind of realize like the physiological portion of it isn't anything related to like what the sport is they'll say that it is, you know, good for building mental toughness. What's your take on conditioning for mental toughness?
You know, that's something obviously as a former football player and a strength coach, right, that everybody talks about mental toughness, and everybody has their own definition, right? So I'm not going to claim to have the same definition that everybody else has or everybody's perception. In my mind, mental toughness is doing what's required of you when the time is required. But basically what I'm saying is when things get hard, can you personally push through it? I don't personally think you can make somebody mentally tough. I think athletes either have it or they don't. Okay. You can do all the drills, all the mat drills, all that stuff, which we do some of that stuff. Do I think it's great? I think there's a good component to it, but do I think it's going to make you a mentally tough person? No, I think you're born a mentally tough person, or you've been exposed to people and mentors and people that have allowed you to become mentally tough, you know, but doing what is needed and what is required when the time happens. So when that time comes, when it's something hard and you can say, I'm going to get it done, that's being mentally tough in my opinion. Like I said, there may be other people out there and you now might get roasted for that too, but I don't personally think you can teach mental toughness. I think you can give athletes the tools to become mentally tough, but I don't think I can take a kid who is not mentally tough and say, well, I'm going to run him into the ground and now he's going to be mentally tough. I don't believe that.
I believe you can make
drills and you can make things where there's a thought component to it. So when you are tired, you have to think and you have to respond and you have to do things correctly. I think you can teach some aspects of that to how to really get things done when you are tired or when you're in a fatigued state. but I don't think you can make somebody really be mentally tough. I think it's just you either have it or you don't.
Yeah. So what my thought process on the whole thing is like, you know, and I deal with a lot of baseball players, no amount of running is going to make someone, you know, handle a 95 mile an hour fastball or a 90 mile an hour fastball or a bullet hit back at them at third base. Like, they're not going to, you know, make that backhanded play at third and say, man, like, I'm so thankful I did those 6 mile runs for a sport that has nothing to do with the, you know, running that long. It really helped me handle that hard hit ball to me, or it really helped me, you know, cloud out the heckling from the fans of the other team when I was in the batter's box or on the mound, or it really helped me turn on that 95 mile an hour fastball and I didn't let it beat me. Like, it just doesn't, it's to lack of a better term, it's a popular term in the baseball industry, it's eyewash in my opinion. And it really, I think what it does is it's an excuse, to basically say like, we're going to throw the, you know, energy systems, definitions, and what's actually being used in the sport out the window. And here's why we don't care that we're doing that, because we think that it does this. And I really think that so much of this could be kind of eased, and all these issues could be kind of dealt with if people just actually watched a sport and determined what the rest to work ratios are. Like, in your opinion, how valuable is that?
It's extremely valuable. And like I said, myself and Coach Scholes, and our staff have these conversations all the time. You know, we look at how we set up any of our energy systems training or any of our quote unquote conditioning days, if you want to call it that. To me, is even a terrible word, but it's one of those things where we look at the style of play. Right, we're a high tempo, a fast paced team in terms of offense. So we're going to train our offensive guys and our defensive guys as well, because they have to go against it, how to really work within the tempo of the game. And, you know, for me, like, you can do everything we want to do to mimic the game of football. You know, I think I saw somebody say something about this the other day. You have training shape, you have practice shape, and you have game shape.
Yep.
You know, we can do everything in our power. And we're like, oh, these guys killed all their running. We're running well, we're bending well, we're strong. And you're still going to have dudes that look like they're tired the first day of practice. Now, what we're trying to do is we're going to try to do some things as we get closer to camp or the training camp that are going to mimic practice and game and plays and drives, so we can at least get them as close as possible to what it's like to actually play a college football game. And it's still not even close to where we could take them from the time we start training camp to the actual first game. So in terms of looking at how long a play lasts, how long the actual exertion is, you know, how long do we rest between drives? How long do we rest between, you know, plays and flipping guys in and out and all those things? We look at all of those things when we're trying to develop our conditioning protocols or our protocols for, you know, our energy systems training. I mean, you have to look at the game. I mean, we're even going so far as looking at watching drills that our linemen are doing, or our linebackers, or our DBs, and how can we work those movement patterns and those drills into our change of direction days or into our linear speed days. You know, we're doing things where we've got our linemen getting in and out of stances all summer. Why? We want them to get used to getting in and out of their stance. You know, so, you know, that I think you have to an extent, look at all the different factors of the sport that you're training for. And, you know, I'm not saying you have to be the sport specific, right? Nothing we ever do is going to be exactly sport specific, but what can we do to get it close to where that we can at least prepare these athletes for the sport that they're going to play? I mean, our 300-pound offensive linemen, what's the point of them running 200, 300-yard shuttles? Absolutely, there's absolutely no reason for that. So I would rather them run repeat 50s or 30s or 40s, give them 15 to 20 seconds rest and go again, because that's going to be closer mimicking a football play as opposed to, you know, having them run hundreds of yards.
Yeah.
Well, it's so I think you really got to look at it. You really have to try to be a movement specialist just as much as you are a strength coach and a strength and conditioning coach, whatever you want to call it, but you have to be a movement specialist as well.
Yeah. I actually, in this thread that made me ask you this question, is I saw a really, really good, it was put really well, by Tony Holler. If you don't follow him, go check him out. He's great. And he basically said that you know, training for a sport like football is basically stacking anaerobic efforts on top of each other that's the best shape that you can be in. So he alluded to the fact that I want to say I know it's Kula is the last name, Kula. I think it's Brandon. He's the trainer that trains Christian McCaffrey. And there's a whole article that basically talks about Christian McCaffrey's conditioning was basically running a full speed route. Like he would get his playbook and he would run his routes and would give himself the same amount of time that you would have in a game in between those bouts, and that'd be his conditioning. And he was getting enough rest every time where he could run pretty much close to full speed in his routes for like 5-6 seconds. And then he would spend the majority of the play clock resting and he would go again. And that is more so like that is that 5-to-6-to-1 rest to work ratio that is basically stacking anaerobic bouts on top of one another. You're best able to get to a point where you can recover enough in between, like most efficiently in between, you know, that 5 or 6 second burst to the point where you can maybe last longer and have, you can maybe, let's say, put it this way. You can put out more of those anaerobic outputs. Like you could, the stack can get taller, so to speak. So like if you stack 20 anaerobic outputs on top of each other with the same rest in between and you train in that manner, maybe you can, you know, stack 25 in a couple weeks and the last five are now able to also be at full speed because you've been training in that sense that that's more based on the actual, you know, ratios of the sport itself. So I thought that was a really, really good point that he brought up in terms of that.
Oh, 100%. You know, it's like, and we have to think about that too, because not only do you have to think about what your team does, at least for us, you know, everybody knows we play in the Big 12, right? It's offense, right? It's up tempo, it's spread, it's everybody all over the field. So we have to prepare not only for our own offense, but we have to prepare for everybody else's offenses, you know, and or defenses, you know, and that's what everybody's kind of running here. So, you know, you're talking some of these guys, us, Oklahoma, some of these really, really up tempo teams, you know, they're trying to get 75 or 80, you know, plays in on offense, you know, where in the NFL, they might be getting 50 or 60 plays in a game. So, I mean, it's a pretty tough deal when you're thinking about the way that these offenses in college football nowadays are really expanding the amount of explosive efforts that these kids are going to have. You know, and we're lucky enough too, that we're able to track some of this stuff with some of the player monitoring things and some of the things that we're lucky enough to have. You know, in a program like ours where we can really say, you know, this guy is being able to repeat this high in sprint or this high in change of direction over and over and over again. So we can actually see now, you know, if these guys are ready to play or not, or as close to getting prepared to play the game as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing too. It's like, even if you go beyond the whole mental touch, it's like, what am I preparing them as best I can for a game? Right. Like, so you're going to have that beginning of the off season where, you know, just like the strength training is going to be a little, you know, further away from the specific demands of a sport, whether in terms of transferability, like the loading and the duration of the exercise, like, you know, you might load a guy, 60% on a squat and have him do 12 reps for hypertrophy. Like, that's not really ideal in terms of transferability to the sport, but it's super early in the off season. So we're pretty far away from that side of the pendulum. Right.
Correct.
The conditioning can work the same way. It's like maybe in the beginning of the off season, I'm only doing like low intensity aerobic work to kind of just give their body time to just recover and recuperate from the off season, or I'm sorry, the in season. Whereas as I get closer to the start of the season, then they're out on the field and they're running, you know, 15 yards, resting 30 seconds, 45 seconds and doing it again. Like it shifts. And it's just like I say about the core all the time. People tend to treat the core differently than how they would train any other body part. Like, you know, you would never just say, okay, let's do 30-second bodyweight squat holds and 30-second push-up holds for your upper and lower body. Like that, in my opinion, that'd be the equivalent of just all you're doing is 30-second plank holds, bodyweight every time. No, you would train your core powerfully and dynamically. You would train it for strength with heavy carries and heavy loading. Conditioning's no different. Like it follows that same timeline across the season. So I think if people just got their head into energy system books and just kind of got the concepts a little bit, but even more important than that, actually just watched the sport and saw like what the sport involved, I think the world would be a better place because, you know, as we know, team sports are alactic in nature, meaning they're not performed in the presence of lactic acid. So if I'm having guys condition heavily in that presence in an anaerobic, dominated sport, it just really makes no sense.
Yeah, you're not preparing their body for what it really needs, and you're making them slower, to be honest with you. you know, when it comes to what we want, right? We want explosive, fast people, right? And I think when you're running long, slow distances like that, it's a detriment, you know, to just pack on that amount of yardage and that amount of yardage and putting it into that type of threshold is just not, it's not going to be beneficial.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just like, why would I want to acclimate myself to something I'm never going to deal with? And it's especially in baseball too. Like, you're a pitcher and you're running these hard, intense pulls after you just threw, and they're telling you the intention of those pulls is to not build up and accumulate, or to break down, I'm sorry, lactic acid. One, that's not how that works. Let's not even go down that road, because that'll just go send me off on a rant. But, you know, we're trying to say that we use something in baseball, like a pole, to break up lactic acid. The way these poles are being run and how intense they are, you're just promoting more lactic acid buildup. Like, you're literally it makes no sense.
Yeah, exacerbating the problem. I'm like, you're trying to get these kids to recover. You know, you'd much rather do some short, repeated effort type stuff than...
Or, like, let them walk. You know, like, go for a... Yeah. Hey, bud, go for a walk around the field for 15, 20 minutes. Like, really slow.
Yeah.
And that's more recovery.
Yeah, I worked with baseball at Southeast Louisiana for quite a while. We had a... Yeah, you know, we had a great head coach there, Matt Reiser. He's still there, former player at Tulane, has done an amazing job. Was an amazing guy to work for with those guys. He
was there pushback from the baseball coach though?
Absolutely not.
No,
Matt was awesome to work with, and then Daniel Latham was our pitching coach. He's actually currently the pitching coach at Tulane. You know, we sat down and said, "Hey, yo, this is kind of what I want our guys to do." So, you know, our Friday night guy would go. He'd come in on Saturday with me. We basically had a path that went around the field, kind of on the outside, and we would have them they'd come in and do a lift with me, kind of a flush out lift to get their shoulders and get their hips and everything moving from the night before, and then we'd do a nice, easy, slow jog. That was about it.
Yeah.
We would do some bike work if it was a guy that we really wanted to make sure that we kept his legs fresh, but there was never anything post-start that was like crazy, crazy intense. Like that, because like I said, the whole point is to flush the system, continue to recover, especially if now you got a kid who's getting ready to have to go on in 6 days, he's expected to go again.
Yeah. And it's just like, if I looked at baseball and I said, okay, like what's a pitch, 2 seconds, a second and a half, like all out effort, even with the pitch clock now, you're getting a 20 second clock, right? So at the worst, you're in a 10-to-1 ratio of rest to work, right? So if I had a guy do if I had a guy do a 20-yard sprint and I realized that took them, I don't know, 2.5 seconds, something like that, whatever it would come out to. And I just multiply that by the 10-to-1 work to rest ratio and had them run their sprints like that. That's a really good way to train a pitcher.
Correct.
Versus like having a guy bash his head in running 4 miles after and it's just killing their legs. And that's another thing that bothers me too. Like, it takes away from the other aspects of sports performance for those pitchers and what they need to be doing. Like, they still need to be jumping and lifting their legs and getting stronger and more explosive. And when you're just ripping their legs apart with longer conditioning, it really can do a lot to set them back. Not only does it not help them, but it can actually hurt them.
Well, yeah, because that, when your legs are worn out, where does all that stress end up going? It worked itself up the chain. And now you're talking shoulders and elbows, because now they're having to use their arm and use their torso a lot more. And that's where you get these guys that have the oblique issues. They have the elbow issues. They have, you know, forearm issues and all those different things, because their legs aren't saving the upper body as much as they should.
Yeah. Yeah. So one last kind of like thing I wanted to leave the listeners with on this energy system topic, and it's something that people don't consider enough, in my opinion, is that even if you're talking about aerobic capacity and it was something you wanted to work on a little bit, people need to understand that it has a 30-day residual effect, meaning it can be maintained for several weeks without even working on it. Like, what does that mean to you, and what would you say about that?
Well, like I said, and a majority of my experience obviously is in alactic sports, you know. So, you know, in terms of any type of aerobic conditioning, you know, like I said, it's like we kind of spoke about a little bit earlier. It's something that we would do kind of at the very, very beginning of our off-season program. And for us, I mean, it's really only, we just do some tempo work with our guys, you know. And you're talking, you know, and some of that comes with kind of some of the NCAA and Big 12 things that we have to do in terms of progressing kids back from a long duration or long periods off. You know, so we have some stipulations from our league where we have to make sure that everything is kind of 50% of what we where we want them to be by, you know, by the end of the semester or the end of the training block. But yeah, I think you there is some use for aerobic capacity work, you know, just to get the kids moving again. But you know, for me, unless it's part of your sport, you know, I don't know if it's something that is really necessary for any team sport athlete, unless there is an aerobic component to what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. And then that's the other thing that's lost on people sometimes is the kind of the bridge between, you know, anaerobic and, you know, alactic to lactic activity is basically what's happening is when the activity is too long where it cannot be fueled without the presence of oxygen, because that's what anaerobic is. Like it's a, you know, creatine phosphate right. fueled, and it's short enough, you know, where oxygen isn't in, you know, involved in it. And if that goes yep. for too long of a period of time, that's when oxygen needs to become available to basically shuttle, you know, glycogen to the muscles, which is like the fuel for muscles, right? So right. if you did want to play devil's advocate and say, okay, like I'd rather make sure that I'm training my aerobic system, which is actually an activity using the presence of oxygen, so that it takes a little longer to get to that lactic threshold, right? So
yes.
I would say, like, if you wanted to do that, you are still missing the boat because you're training too intensely, and it's basically the aerobic isn't being worked because you're pushing past the point where oxygen is, you know, in supply to shuttle, you know, glycogen to the muscles, and then it turns to lactic acid. So it's like if you want to do that, you have to still understand like all the implications of it, how it all works and how it's all broken down. And you really do realize that a lot of the way things are done or the way they were done just isn't effective.
Correct. And it's, you know, it's unfortunately there's a lot of that. You know, this is how I was taught, or quote unquote, this is what we've always done or whatever, you know, and you know, it's one of those things where you have to learn how to take it another step and just say, you know what, maybe this isn't the right thing. Maybe this isn't the right type of training for these guys. Maybe this isn't what we need to better prepare our athletes for practice, for games. You know, I think, you know, some of it was easy, you know, and not saying anybody before me was, well, that was just kind of, hey, let's go run and we'll be in shape and then we go play sports. You know, I think as the science has kind of caught up with it, and as, you know, we as practitioners have continued to kind of advance our thinking and mold our thinking and evolve our thinking, you know, I think, like I said, I mean, the being doing aerobic capacity training or aerobic training in general is not beneficial for, you know, an alactic athlete. It's just not.
Yeah, it's I guess kind of say no more on the topic. We kind of hashed that enough, but that was awesome because I really wanted to go over that and kind of give the listeners a little bit to chew on in terms of, you know, what maybe is wrong with how things are done, and obviously give them a little bit of insight on, you know, the right way to do things. So I think that was tremendous. Another kind of hot topic, current debate going on. I don't know if you call it a debate, and I'll preface this by saying, like, I'm a very big gray area type of person, and, like, you know, kind of predicate myself on determining, you know, athlete needs, you know, based on key performance indicators. And that's the kind of coach that I am. So I think when we, you know, I see this sprinting versus strength training debate on social media, it kind of makes me roll my eyes because I just don't know why we can't look at each other and say sprinting is king. And it's really important if you're talking about developing speed, but like, why can't we understand that, you know, how much an athlete should lift and how much strength they need can just be based on, you know, the feedback we're getting from what we're doing. You know, instead of saying one's not needed versus the other, or kind of demonizing one, in light of the other. So what is your take on that whole thing? And like, what have you seen and what is your opinion on it?
Well, you know, my thing is it's one thing I love about this profession, and I love about different being able to talk to with different people is, you know, there is no one right way to do everything, right? There's a multitude of different ways to get the to get the kids to perform and to get the results that you're looking for. In terms of me, I think you got to do both. I mean, it's hard for me to really see where somebody's saying, well, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that, or you should do more of this or more of that. I think everything comes in waves. You know, I think through in an off season phase, you know, when you're coming off and you're coming off in the end season, I think lifting may have a little more of the priority as opposed to sprinting. I think for us, we still sprint all year round in any off season, whether it's a springtime or a summertime. You know, so I think the amount of sprinting and the level and the amount of sprinting in terms of the and in terms of the and the amount of times that we're sprinting, I think those are what's going to ebb and flow throughout the year. You know, the way that the Coach Scholes and our staff has set up our program now is it's, you know, from in January, right? It's let's get back, get strong, let's get bent. We're gonna go back and we're gonna work on our mechanics. We're gonna go and do some low level type stuff in terms of we're just gonna do repeat tens. We're gonna work on stances. We're gonna work on arm action. You know, we're gonna work on a variety of those things. We may do a little bit of resistance sprinting and do some contrast work. And then as we progress into the summer, right, I think the amount of emphasis on strength training is going to decrease a little bit. And the amount of time we're going to spend sprinting and doing change of direction work and plyometric work, I think that's going to obviously increase because, right, we're getting ready to go play the sport. And like I said, it all kind of goes back to getting them prepared for the sport. So, you know, in my personal opinion, I don't think you can say one or the other in terms of whether there's, you know, you need to do more resistance sprinting or whether you need to do more lifting, you know, and there's also the thing you hear a lot about as well. If he's lifting two and a half times, if he's squatting 2.5 times his body weight, there's no carryover. And I'm like, okay, well, I haven't yet to see where it's like, okay, well, I know for a fact that he doesn't need to squat anymore because he's already hit this number. Well, this arbitrary number doesn't really work for every single player or every single person because there's some biomechanical deficiencies, possibly there's some mechanical things that we can work on. You know, maybe this kid needs to continue to gain body mass or change his body composition. You know, I don't think people take into account how much speed is affected by body composition as well. You know, so, you know, there's a lot of extenuating circumstances. So I don't think you can really point your finger to one particular way of doing things. I think you have to understand where you are going, and it goes back to planning and programming, right? Where our emphasis in the summertime, as we get closer and closer to August, is let's get them fast. Let's get them to be great accelerators. Let's get them to be great at movers, great change of direction. Let's get our big guys used to moving and putting the foot in the ground. And then the weight room can kind of be a little more basic in terms of what we're doing. We're still going to squat. We're still going to clean. You know, we're still going to press, you know, but maybe we spend a little less time in the weight room and a little more time on the field.
Yeah, and that's the biggest thing too, is like people just need to understand that if I have ways that I can determine, you know, what direction my programming needs to go in based on the feedback I'm getting. So like if I use a vertical jump test and I'm doing static testing and counter movement testing, and you know, I have ways to determine, you know, relative strength and power, I can see if, you know, going from a 405 on the back squat for, you know, 180 pound athlete to 435 is going to, or did it yield, or is it going to yield results, versus just saying like, oh, I've reached this arbitrary like 1.7 or 2.0 number in my head, and I'm definitely going to stop doing that because it has no carryover. If I, you know, continue to have them, you know, squat heavy and they go from 405 to 435, my vertical went up a little bit after doing that, like, why would I be pissed that I did that? Like, that'd be a good thing. It contributed to something. And I also have, you know, evidence and testing to kind of give me that answer. But the other thing too is, you know, people also need to understand, like, because there's one side of the argument that needs to get that there is tremendous benefit to building force when athletes aren't genetically gifted. And there's also, you know, tremendous benefit to lifting heavy in terms of motor unit recruitment. So that, like, I would say that's for the side that, like, says, hey, the heavy lifting isn't really necessary. And then for the side that says, you know, squatting 900 pounds is king to get faster, you know, make them understand that ground contact in a sprint is under, you know, a tenth of a second. So know the two of those things and kind of no tests that you're going to have to give you the answers, and put them all together, and it can really give you a nice universal viewpoint on, like, what you should be doing, in my opinion.
Right. And like I said, it all goes to, you know, when you really get into it, it's like looking, it's looking and knowing each individual athlete, right? Say I have a linebacker, right? And I need him to really run well. Okay. Well, no, okay. The kid weighs 240, right? And he back squats 500 pounds. Okay. He's double his body weight. But maybe his body composition isn't where it needs to be. So yeah, is he still gonna squat over 80% or 85%? You know, and we're trying to develop some max strength and push that number a little bit. Great. But if I could get him to stay at that 240 range and I can get his nutrition on point and get him leaner, you know, like Coach Scholes, another buddy of mine, Alan Bishop over at the University of Houston, maybe they say fat don't fly. So, I mean, you could be naturally twitchy and strong. Okay, but then maybe getting that portion of it locked in can even increase a little bit more without me even changing what I'm doing.
Yeah, just so that relative strength, that ratio. Like we use chin ups as a good test for that. Like if you're 180 and you go to 195 and now you do one less chin up, I think we have a problem. Like,
yeah,
you probably relative strength wise, you're now probably less strong per pounds of body weight that you have, and maybe you put some weight on that isn't ideal. But if I gain 15 pounds and go up in 5 chin ups, then I'm cooking. Then I'm in a good spot.
Yeah, correct. We'll use that a little bit, and we'll sit down as a staff and we'll talk about, because we'll have a little day here where we may have some guys come in and do some extra lifts. Maybe it's a guy that, they're great accelerators, right? But their top end isn't good. So if we look at the way that they're running, so we can adjust our strength training program to produce some results in those particular quote unquote indicators, as you talk about. So if a guy's a great accelerator, or if he has really great top end, but he's not a great accelerator, maybe he needs to get a little bit stronger, right? If he's not good off the start, but once he gets up to speed, he's really good.
Yeah.
Okay? Or maybe the other way around. Maybe the guy's
explosive.
Maybe the guy's explosive and powerful off the line, but his top end isn't very good. Okay. So what do we need to do there? Maybe he doesn't need to lift. Maybe his lifting needs to change, and his sprint volume needs to go up a little bit, or needs to change. Or what we need to work on with that guy individually. And some of that stuff is what we'll look at when we go into like our May program, or even into our April or our post spring ball. We'll try to do some more individualized type training with our guys.
Yeah, you brought up a really good point too. A guy has trouble accelerating and realizing how much of acceleration is dependent upon force and the amount of force you can put into the ground with longer ground contact time. Like, that's a really good point. Like, if I look at it, you said you had a linebacker, I think it was, and they're struggling to, get off the line in their first couple strides, or their 40 is lacking in those first 10 or 15 yards. And, you increase their raw force output, that could have a really big effect on, their ability to accelerate. Or if you look at an athlete that's having a little more trouble in the top end, maybe, some more plyometric work and some stiffness and ground contact that could have a lot of benefit. So that's why I just get so frustrated when people try to be one-sided about it, because it's impossible to do so if you really look at everything and every, turn every stone over and kind of just see what is involved in all of these processes. There's so many components.
Correct.
Yeah. So to finish up on this, kind of a couple of miscellaneous speed questions, and you alluded to resisted sprinting back when we, first started talking about the sprinting versus strength training debate. Do you use resisted sprints? And I guess the other question would be, and you kind of touched on this a little bit as well with, beginning of the off season versus end of the off season, but in a typical training week, let's say you're smack dab in the middle of the off season, how often are your athletes sprinting, like the average athlete? And are, like I said, are you using resisted sprints? And if so, how do you use them?
Well, yeah, like I said, in our program here, when Coach Scholes kind of gets his stuff situated, and I am a firm believer in what he's doing with our program and how we're setting things up here, is, We do resisted sprinting. We don't use a crazy amount of weight. We actually use chains here, so we don't actually use sleds. We use a chain for most of our guys. In terms of the amount of times we're sprinting, in the right smack down in the middle of season, we're sprinting at least twice a week.
Okay.
Sprinting twice a week. So that's we're always doing that. Whether and we're doing a variety of different things. We're doing, like I said, we're doing resisted starts. We're doing unresisted starts. We're doing hard starts, push-up starts, different variations, some things. We're big fans and really good friends with Derek Hansen, so we've learned a lot from him. We've been out to see him a few times, so we use a lot of things we learned from Derek over the years. But like I said, we do flying work. I mean, there's a variety of different, things that we're doing, and we're a big quality-based team in terms of our sprinting, right? We're in there to get quality reps. We're not in there, like I said, that's, you go back to energy system. This is not a conditioning day when it comes to sprinting. If it's sprinting, it's maximal recovery, maximal effort. You're running as hard and as fast as you can. That's kind of, I think, sometimes get lost because they're like, oh, that's a great workout. My guys are worn out. I'm like, well, no, that means they got slower. The whole point is any of our speed days, it's maximal recovery, maximal effort, full out. And it may be 6 great reps, and then we progress up throughout the semester, and maybe we're finishing with 10 to 12 full speed reps from a variety of different stances, whether it's resisted, unresisted, but we are definitely a team that sprints And we'll do it multiple times a week throughout the year, even as we get into our summer program.
Yeah, I would say if you're a listener, you can kind of just take that entire last little bit and say, here's a guy that, you know, understands the importance of lifting, and his guys are sprinting twice a week. So if that doesn't tell you that there's, you know, level, you know, middle ground to be had, then I don't know what will.
Like I said, there's no 100% right answer, but I think you got to use every aspect and every tool in your toolbox to give the best program to your kids and get the, so they can get the most benefit out of the program regardless.
I couldn't agree more on that. So to kind of wrap things up here, I always, you know, apologize for doing this, but I like to put my guests on the spot a little bit and ask them if they have any closing thoughts, anything that you maybe wanted to get to that we didn't touch on, or, you know, anything in the back of your mind that you haven't been able to say, to maybe just kind of wrap up what we talked about. But, you know, that was phenomenal.
You know, the first thing, I just, like I said, I spoke on these guys earlier, but I want to thank a lot of the great people first that I've been lucky enough to talk with. And like I said, Mark Uyama, Dave Scholes, Tom Melton, Richard Borden, Gail Hatch, who I was able to train with for 4 years while I was in Louisiana. Didn't really get to mention him earlier, but Coach Hatch was an awesome mentor and friend. Paul Jackson, like I said, he's an unbelievable friend and mentor. You know, I've really been lucky enough to really be around great people. And that kind of goes back to what I talked to it about, these young kids and young guys coming up, is find good people and learn and talk with them. One thing I'm real big on in terms of, you know, it's really great to be a coach and to be able to train kids and do these things in the weight room. But I always tell people, you know, we're in the people building business as much as we are in the athletic development business, you know. So if we can develop great people, great leaders, great fathers, great husbands, and we can teach them some things that they can take with them as they go off after their playing careers are over, and that they can implement it to their lives with their families and their children later on, I think, you know, that's one of the biggest things that I've found in my career that I've really been happy about. You know, still have kids that I've worked with 10 years ago that I talk to that'll call me and say, Coach, how you doing? You know, I just had a baby, you know, or my son is doing this, you know, and whatever, you know, it's really awesome to really be able to impact lives of kids and be able to develop great leaders and people. And, you know, these guys are going off in their communities and doing great things. And I think that for me is probably the most beneficial thing than all the rings and all the championships and winning games and going to bowl games and all these great things that we do. You know, it's, you know, I want to be able to give myself to these kids and be able to develop great people. Man, and I think that to an extent, it's never about me. It's never about anybody else. It's about what I can do for my athletes. And, you know, that's, I don't think it gets lost, but I want people to just remember that it's about these kids and what we can do for them.
Yeah. That's why, right. That's why we do what we do. And that's why I have this podcast. And, you know, that's the motivation behind a lot of stuff is how can you make the athletes better and how can you make people better coaches? And, you know, you kind of touched on two things that come full circle there about, you know, the coaches you wanted to thank and mention, for the impact they had on you and, you know, the impact you're now able to have on a lot of athletes. It's kind of cool how it's like one big tree and, you know, one hand leads to the other. And, you know, ultimately we all kind of stand on the shoulders of other people, you know, to help those, you know, that we get to interact with every day. So I think that was, you know, really well said and a good way to kind of end things for sure.
Yeah, it was an awesome opportunity. I appreciate you having me on.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right, Coach. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, absolutely. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Muscles and Management Podcast brought to you by Challenger Strength. I'm your host, Jared DiFilippo, signing off on the show that's changing the way we view training, sports performance, and business.